some controversy over new pictures circulating on social media. The spokesman, with a strong Spanish accent, is saying that this is very unhelpful, that the police team are building a rapport with the hostage taker, and this is damaging, dangerous, irresponsible. The reporter is saying that it must surely be impossible these days to control things, what with social media. Next, the spokesman is agitated, says he has to end the interview to take a phone call, but is urging people to please be sensible, not to share these pictures. Please. The news moves on to another story. Matthew checks his watch again and looks at the bag of washing on the passenger seat. He has agreed to pop in to see Ella and meet her husband, but he does not want to stay long. He needs to get home and get these chores done for Sally. Amazing how many baby grows and bibs and bits and bobs a tiny baby can work through in 24 hours. There is also a list of things his wife needs. Lip salve, tissues, some kind of body lotion. He's forgotten the name already and is glad she wrote it down. Matthew tries a few different radio channels. What pictures? What the hell is going on in Spain now? He finds himself imagining the team briefings behind the scenes. He feels the familiar pull, the sense of loss, regret. Remembers sitting alone in his new office soon after leaving the force, so desperately missing the sense of being part of something, something really important. So, how are you adjusting? Sally asked him back then, night after night. He always lied. Fine. I'm fine. Matthew left the force because he messed up. He was responsible for the death of a boy of just 12. His boss begged him to stay, to take time out to reconsider and to go through some counselling. There was an inquest and there was an independent police inquiry. Both exonerated him of all blame, but that made no difference to Matthew. He was the one who had to look the mother in the eye at the inquest. He was the one who woke at night, sweating. It had been a Thursday, raining that night too. He was called out by a small, independent supermarket, sick of shoplifters. A boy had snatched some cigarettes while the manager was serving another customer, and then bolted. Matthew happened across the child, running down an alleyway not far from the shop. He gave chase. Oi, you! Stop now! Even as he ran, Matthew was planning to let the child off with a warning. He had done this several times. The lad was fast, but short. Just a kid. But Matthew never got the chance to be lenient. The boy panicked and bolted over a fence and down a bank to the railway line. Matthew shouted for him to stop, but the boy ran across. It was a live line. It was a terrible sight. A terrible smell. Matthew was badly burned while pulling the child from the live rail. I should never have chased him, he told Sally. If I hadn't made him panic, he would be alive. Two packets of cigarettes, Sally. Two sodding packets of cigarettes. You were just doing your job. His wife stroked his hair. He always remembers how tenderly she stroked his hair as he talked and talked all night. And so Matthew turned his back on his job. Turned his back on supermarkets who wanted him to chase shoplifters, no matter their age, no matter their motive. He decided to set up his own business, imagining that it would be better to pick and choose who he helped. The only problem, as Mel so frequently reminds him, is that he is bored, cut off from the really important cases. Not many people come to a private investigator with important cases. Too often it is missing people, who disappear because they do not want to be found, and wives worried about their husbands playing away. Matthew fumbles in the glove box and finds a forgotten chocolate bar. Good. Sugar. He is now remembering the negotiator's course, being so surprised by the statistics, that the majority of hostage situations are actually resolved without injury. Of course, that was before suicide attacks, before the new wave of very different crimes. The team in Spain will hopefully be doing it by the book, old school, just as Sally guessed. They would be praising Carl for keeping things calm, keeping Anna safe. Well done, you are doing great. This won't be forgotten, that you are keeping everyone safe. Matthew closes his eyes and wishes it were him, in the police van, on the phone, in charge. Never use the word surrender, they were taught. Coming out was the preferred phrase. Let's talk about how you can come out safely, Carl, how we can help you out of there safely. During one of the seminars, Matthew asked how they were supposed to respond to demands. Hostage takers always make bonkers demands, a getaway car, a helicopter, and money. What was the official police response to ransom demands? Never say no, the instructor advised. Just say, I'll look into that for you, Carl. Negotiators should always appear to pass requests through other people, so any negativity or delays do not seem to be their fault. I'm so sorry, Carl. They're telling me that's not possible at the moment. Let's talk about what is possible, how we keep everyone safe. That's going to really count for you. I'm doing my best for you, Carl. I promise. Matthew is still about 15 minutes from Ella's house and can no longer bear the wait. He pulls into a lay-by. He has to know what all this blessed talk of pictures is about. He pulls out his phone and calls up Twitter. The images are everywhere. Shots from several different angles, of Carl with a gun to the head of a blonde woman, presumably Anna, at the window. Matthew feels his heart race as he forces himself into that professional gear, the place where you fight the fear and the panic, and you switch on your analytical brain. Okay, what does this mean? What needs to be done? He begins to analyze all the pictures as swiftly as he can. What do they really say? What is really going on? The problem is that in all the shots, Anna has her back to the window. Matthew finds maybe half a dozen different photographs taken from slightly different angles and frowns. Feels his brain burning, sparks flying as involuntarily he makes connections he does not yet understand. In the force, he learned to trust his gut when this happened, to relax and look and wait. It is a bit like that series of posters, Magic Eye, where you have to stare and relax your eyes until you almost go into a trance to see the three-dimensional image appear. Relax, trust your natural ability. He is flicking between all the pictures and doing the same thing. Something is not quite right. He skims through the messages circulating on social media. The comments are meant to be kind, but are seriously unhelpful. OMG, is he gonna shoot her? There are some messages on Twitter from the police, too, in Spanish and in English, asking people not to take and share photographs, but it is clearly making no difference. Jesus. A shambles. Matthew skims again through the range of pictures, this time searching news agency coverage. Some seem better quality, taken by a long-range lens, possibly a press photographer. But most look as if they were taken on phones, perhaps from the window of upper-floor flats opposite the block where Carl is holed up. And then he finds a different shot, taken from much higher up. Maybe the top floor of a block of flats, looking down at the window from a different, sharper angle. Now, at last, Matthew sees what was troubling him in the other photographs. He takes out his iPad to call up the same image and to zoom in a bit. Even as he is dialing Melanie's number, he is emailing this image to her. She has to make sure the Spanish team have seen this. Jesus Christ, they need to see this. 5 rings before Melanie picks up. Mel, I'm sending a photograph over right now. Carl at the window with his hostage. You have to get a message through to the Spanish team. Matthew? Sorry, yes, it's Matt, on my way home from hospital. I don't have the picture yet. What's going on? Remember, I'm persona non grata, practically on gardening leave. I don't think it's Anna, Mel. What? The girl with Carl, the girl he's taken hostage. I'm not convinced it's Anna. But that's crazy. Oh, wait, the picture's through. Okay, so what am I supposed to be seeing here? Shoulder width. Wrong body shape, Mel. A rectangle, not a pear. What? Okay, right. Matthew tries to calm his voice, realizes this is going to sound as if he has finally lost his marbles. Sal, she's obsessed with the body shape stuff. What clothes to buy? Anna is a pear. Not fat, not at all. A very slim pear. Jesus Christ, Matt, have you got baby brain or something? No, listen, this is important. I couldn't give a stuff about this, but one night Sal made me look at all this nonsense in a magazine, so I would stop buying her the wrong clothes as presents. Body shape apparently doesn't change much, even if you lose or put on weight. It's about bones, skeleton, fixed. Anna, from all the photographs her family shared, is a classic pear, same as my wife. A slim pear. Tiny waist, slim shoulders, and tiny upper body, slightly broader hips. This girl, the girl in the flat with Carl, is a totally different body shape. Straight up, straight down. Zoom in and look. Shoulders same width as her hips. No proper waistline. It only shows up in this photograph from the higher angle. There is silence for a while. Are you seeing it, Mel? Check back with the file photos of Anna, please. Compare them. Compare the shoulders. Another pause. Christ, I think you might be right. But there's no way the team's going to listen to me blabbering on about body shape. I'm technically off the case until I see the chief and try to talk my way out of my meltdown with D.I. Halfwit. So how about phoning your mate, Kathy, the family liaison officer? I take it she's with them. We need to know fast. Matthew can hear Melanie taking a long breath. Please, Mel, if I'm right and this isn't Anna, they need to take a whole different approach. Also, if this isn't Anna... A pause. Where the hell is she and what's Carl playing at? A huff. Okay, I'll send this pic to Kathy. See if she will very gently sound out the family. But she may point blank refuse. Okay, look, I'm about to make a house call myself on the case. The witness, Ella. I promise to share anything I have if you'll keep me in the loop. Please. Okay. Though I might be looking for a new job myself. Don't say that, Mel. I was banking on you rising through the ranks so I could make a comeback. Matthew was surprised to hear himself say this out loud for the first time. You kidding me? Of course I'm kidding. He isn't. Okay. Speak to you soon. It takes about 15 minutes to Ella's home, the rain getting heavier so that he wishes he had thought to put a coat in the car. Matthew checks his watch. He needs to crack on if he's going to get home in time to get the chores done and get a decent night's kip. According to Ella and all around him, this is soon to be the stuff of dreams. Poor Sally is having trouble breastfeeding and is already talking about switching to formula. Matthew doesn't mind either way, but is picking up hints that he may well be taking a share of the night feeds. He's starting to wonder how on earth people do it, work when they have newborns. Pulling up onto the drive of the house, behind a large black BMW, Matthew realizes that Ella's husband must be home. He checks his phone. No message yet from Melanie. Damn. And braces himself for the rain between the car and the porch. There is no light on in the hall, but after a few moments he can hear an interior door squeak, strained voices, the click of a light, and then Ella is opening the door. She looks pale. We've been watching it all on the news. Terrible. Have you seen? Yes. Matthew stamps his feet on the doormat. To the right there is a bamboo umbrella stand containing two large golfing umbrellas, a briefcase. The husband definitely home then. Matthew takes in that the briefcase is expensive, the leather well kept. A smart men's raincoat on the nearest hook, silk lining. Ella is babbling about the news coverage, how shocking it is for so many pictures to be circulating on social media. Matthew is just nodding, waiting to size up her husband's attitude. In the sitting room, the tension is immediate. Tony is introduced, his body language all conflict, shoulders held tense. He shakes Matthew's hand but is unblinking, then narrows his eyes, making no effort to conceal that he is weighing Matthew up. I should have told Tony before, I realize that now. We normally tell each other everything, so I feel very bad indeed. Ella is looking first at Matthew, and then her husband. Ping-pong paranoia. Ella is a very nice woman, and Matthew does not like to see her distressed. I was just so sure that the postcards were from Mrs. Ballard, you see. And what do you think, Mr. Hill? Matthew meets Tony's stare and takes a deep breath. I think it's understandable that you would be worried, perhaps skeptical even, about my involvement. That's why I was happy when Ella suggested this update. I am hoping I can allay any fears. I'm listening. I was in the force myself. I have a lot of experience and I still have good contacts. And between these four walls, strictly not to go any further, I think they are making an unholy mess of the Anna Ballard inquiry, and I am increasingly glad to be involved. To help you, Ella, obviously, but also, I hope, to help get to the bottom of this case in any way I can. Well, that's very noble, I'm sure, but my main worry here is my wife's safety. That's what we're paying you for, not to solve the Anna Ballard case. That's for the police team. So, do you think Ella is in any real danger? These postcards?
Tony, please.
Ella continues to glance from one to the other.
We're all worried sick about Anna. Of course we are, Matthew. Have you seen the photograph with the gun to her head? Do you think they will calm it down or use a sniper? What do you think? I feel so terrible, so worried. Just think what poor Mrs. Ballard must be.
Tony puts his arm around his wife's shoulders, kissing her forehead to quieten her, and Matthew watches closely. Tony smooths his wife's hair very tenderly, and Matthew reassesses the aggression, no longer minding Tony's disapproval. He would be the same were it Sal. No, it is good that Tony is protective. I've involved a colleague I trust over the postcards. There is no way to be sure at this stage, but it is more likely to be some random who has latched onto the case. There is no evidence of a real threat as things stand. That said, I prefer caution until we know more, and I have advised Ella to take care. Is there anything else to update me on? Anything unusual? Anything worrying you? Ella, for a moment, looks flustered, fidgets with her hair.
A couple of times, I thought someone was watching the shop early in the morning, but it could just be paranoia, headlights shining into the shop early. It just unnerved me because I'm jumpy.
You didn't tell me this. Tony's eyes are wide with alarm. Right, that's it. No more working early in the shop. He turns to Matthew. Back me up here, please. She just won't listen. We've installed new alarms, though it's all a bit shambolic.
Did you see anyone, Ella, watching the shop?
No, it was just a feeling, really. Probably because I've been so upset over all of this.
Well, my advice would be to close the shop for a couple of days while this situation pans out in Spain. Matthew is staring directly at Tony.
Alleluia, my thinking exactly.
Tony takes a deep breath.
But what about my flower orders?
Stuff the orders, Ella. I'll ring the customers and say you're ill. Recommend other shops just for a couple of days.
Tony seems pleased, instantly happier, and signals the way through to the kitchen where he is more polite, offering coffee which Ella begins to make. The TV news is on in this room too, and they all glance at it when they hear a newsreader sharing the latest pictures from the flat in Spain. While Ella is bustling over the coffee grinder and cafetiere, Matthew checks his phone. Still no message from Melanie. As Ella waits for the coffee to stew a while, she turns to Matthew.
So, will they try to shoot him?
Carl,
is that what they'll do? I find it so unbearable just watching and waiting.
A negotiator will be trying to talk him down, persuade him to come out. It's a waiting game. They won't opt for intervention unless they have no choice. If it is Anna, let's remember he has kept her alive for a year.
If it's Anna? Who the hell could it be if it's not Anna?
Tony's voice is incredulous, and Matthew wishes he had not shared this. Chapter 38. The Friend.
You still haven't explained why you feel it's your fault, Sarah.
Lily has made sandwiches on a large platter with slices of apple and peach, which she sets on top of the dresser in her room.
You really need to try to eat something.
Sarah's stomach is still unsettled. She looks at the platter, so carefully arranged, and then at her sister. The irony of Lily, all bones beneath her baggy disguise.
I don't know if I can eat. You have some.
Sarah watches her sister closely, but Lily shrugs.
I ate earlier.
Sarah lets the lie go. She scans Lily's bedroom, at least pleased for this new privacy, fed up with Moon and the others poking their heads around the door and interfering downstairs, that she is sorry to be away from the large television. She flicks between social media and the news updates on her phone, but is wishing now she had an iPad so that she could see better. Also a better data package. She has had warning texts that she's at her limit. No money to top it up.
Would you mind calling it up on your laptop, Lily? The coverage.
Sarah will not call her Saffron. She watches and tries to find a smile as a thank you, as her sister sets up the computer, searching for a rolling news channel.
Okay, but don't dodge the question, Sarah. This Carl is clearly a nutter, and I'm so very sorry this is so frightening for you. What's going on in Spain, I mean. But to be perfectly honest, I'm just relieved Dad wasn't involved. And if Anna upped and went off with this guy Carl, she didn't up and go off with him.
Sarah lets this hang in the air and feels suddenly exhausted. It is a bit like that feeling when you stand on a bridge and there is this tiny part of you that wants to jump, to join the water. You know that you shouldn't, but you can't help the feeling. And you know that there is this really important decision to be made in a second, and it is frightening. The consequence. The thin line between one choice and the other. Just like with the bottle and the pills, though she realizes now that this did not end it. Solve it. Just made it go on and on and on.
At least, I don't know if she did. Or if he took her, or spiked her drink or whatever, because the point is I didn't look out for her. We had a bad row, me and Anna, and the truth is, I just don't know what the hell happened.
Sarah realizes, as she listens to her own voice, gabbling suddenly, that she just needs an end to this, however awful and shaming and terrible. And her sister, this shrunken and sad version of the sister she has so missed, is her only hope for a full stop. Lily sits on the end of her bed, her expression changing. A deep frown, then a sort of twitch of the head.
You need to tell me, Sarah. Please.
Fidgeting with the bands around her wrist again, which makes Sarah want to cry for her. For them both. There was a long pause. A deep breath that Sarah realizes must be her own. And jump.
We had agreed to stay at the club until about 2 a.m. and then take a taxi back to the hotel together. I was chatting with Anthony to start with, and Anna was with Carl. It was okay at first. We felt really grown up. I feel stupid admitting that now, but it's the truth. But then they both sort of lost interest in us. They seemed to know quite a few people. Just wandered off. Pretty much ignored us.
Sarah's voice quietens as she remembers how it felt. How angry she felt. How ashamed and duped at how hard she had tried to make Anthony like her on the train. How quickly he was off, laughing and flirting with other girls at the club. She had thought when they invited them out that it would be like a double date. She had imagined they would sit, the four of them, dance, have fun together. But no. I always get it so wrong with boys, with men, Lily. She's looking up at her sister now. They call me a slag in school.
You are not a slag.
She can feel tears on her cheeks and closes her eyes, not caring.
I just want people to like me.
She keeps her eyes closed, but can hear the creak of the bed as Lily moves to put her arms around her.
Shh, shh, Sarah. It's going to be all right.
She shakes off the comfort.
No, it's not. Anna came to me at about 12:30 and said that she wanted to go early. She'd had enough. She was tired, very tipsy. But I was looking for Anthony still. I was a bit drunk too and really cross with him, so I told Anna not to be such a baby, to have another drink and to chill out.
Sarah wipes her cheek with one hand, the salty taste of the tears now on her lips.
That's why we rowed. She told me she didn't feel safe anymore, and I more or less told her to piss off, to make her own way back.
And that's when she suggested contacting Dad.
Yeah, she said that maybe we should get him to come to the club and see us back to the hotel. But I said she was being pathetic, and if she contacted Dad, I would never speak to her again.
Did you tell the police this?
No, of course not. I lied. I said Anna was the one who didn't turn up for the taxi later.
Sarah opens her eyes to try to read her sister's judgment. Lily looks shocked, and Sarah remembers the look of shock on Anna's face, too.
Please, I want to go back to the hotel now. I feel a bit too drunk. Please, Sarah, I'm begging you.
She's wondering how much worse all their faces will look
when they find out what happened on the train with Anthony.
Later, I couldn't find her, so I had to take a taxi on my own. I thought she would be back in our room already, cross with me. I thought I would have the chance to get sober, say sorry. But when she didn't come back to the hotel, I was in this incredible panic at first that maybe she had got in contact with Dad. Jeez. I was so confused, Lily. Back then, I didn't even know if I was wrong to think so badly about Dad. Paranoid. I started to think, what if Anna did phone his hotel and he came to the club, met her outside or something? Oh, I don't know, just mad worries firing round my brain because of the way he is, Lily. But I was too scared to tell the police.
She looks directly into Lily's eyes, whose expression says she understands.
And then Carl and Anthony did a bunk, and so I thought it was way more likely to be them. And this finally confirms it, that Carl just took her, God knows what.
Sarah is openly sobbing now.
So it is my fault. Either way, I messed up, Lily. I completely let Anna down.
Chapter 39. The Father. I'm wondering if you should phone the family doctor, maybe a sedative or something, to help Barbara calm down. Kathy, the family liaison officer, is stroking Barbara's back as she sits, head between her knees, on a chair at the kitchen table. Henry is standing, hands on both hips, crippled by his own turbulent and twisted emotions. Fear, guilt, shame. You disgust me. That awful image on the television, which in the end he had to turn away from. That crazy lunatic with a gun to his daughter's head. All he could think of in that moment was of his own shotgun, which the police have confiscated, of wanting it back, to point and aim, to shoot him. Carl. Dead. There, take that. In the chest, in the head. He paces as Kathy soothes his wife and keeps looking up at him for direction.
I don't want a doctor. I don't want a sedative. I need to know what's happening. Oh, my God. My baby. My poor baby.
Barbara's voice is rising again, and Kathy is shushing her, telling her to breathe calmly, to take long, slow breaths. She has sleeping tablets, but she doesn't like taking those. Henry feels his lip trembling as he watches his wife's shoulders heaving with the strain of trying to maintain control. I really think you should lie down for a bit, Barbara. Upstairs, we'll bring you any news as soon as we hear anything at all. Kathy is still stroking Barbara's back. Are you sure you don't want the doctor? Barbara looks around the room then, as if not seeing what is in front of her.
No, doctor. I want to be in Anna's room. I'll lie down in Anna's room.
She gets up with an odd and worrying look on her face, trance-like at this new purpose. Get Jenny to go with her. Kathy is directing this at Henry, her eyes wide with concern. Henry, meantime, is helpless, pacing, not quite processing the information. Get your daughter to go upstairs. Sit with Barbara. She mustn't be on her own. Kathy's mobile is ringing once more, and Henry again feels the shudder that coursed through him when he first saw the picture on the television. Kathy says she must take the call, and so Henry moves back into the sitting room to tell Jenny to go upstairs, please, to help her mother. Tim stands, clearly wondering what he should do. The television is now muted, but the picture is of sports coverage. Henry feels a punch of outrage that the world is moving on already. Less than half an hour since that maniac stood his daughter by the window, gunned to her golden hair, and the world has moved on to the football. I really think you'd better go, Tim. Sorry, but it's all just too much for us. Tim just nods, white and shaken, grabbing his coat from the back of the sofa. Henry hears the click of the front door as Tim leaves at last, then moves back into the kitchen, trying to listen in on Kathy's call. She has gone through to the boot room and closed the door. Infuriating. Her voice is muted by the thick oak door. Sammy has taken the opportunity to sneak through from the boot room and sits now at Henry's feet, eyes pleading for permission to stay with him in the kitchen. Henry looks at his dog. The glint of amber in his dark eyes. The loyalty. The concern, picking up the tension in the room. He is remembering the puppy on the front lawn, yapping and bouncing to and fro, as Anna completed cartwheel after cartwheel on the grass.
Look, Daddy, I can do 3 in a row.
Henry moves even closer, leaning right by the boot room door. But it is hopeless. He still cannot hear. Kathy is whispering. The desperation to know what is going on burns in Henry's chest like a tearing of the flesh. He closes his eyes. His breath comes loud and labored through his nose. Sammy is at his side again, nuzzling his leg. Can I stay, Master? Henry pats his dog's head and feels something inside him break as the dog's tail begins to wag. Finally, Henry moves over to the scrubbed pine table on automatic pilot, sitting in the high-backed farmhouse chair vacated by his wife. Only now does he notice that the blue checked cushion normally on the chair is lying on the floor, just under the table. For a moment he becomes fixated on the cushion, trying to decide if he should pick it up. For a few seconds, this decision feels momentous, too difficult to make. And then he is telling himself how stupid and futile and ridiculous it is to even think about this. How little it matters if all the cushions are on the floor. Every stupid thing in this stupid room on the floor. He glances around, clocking all the china, the plates and the jugs and the bowls, and the paraphernalia on the dresser, thinking for a moment that he would like to sweep his arm across it all. Send it all to the floor, to join the cushion. At last, there is the familiar squeak of the boot room door, Sammy standing, tail stilled, wondering if he is going to be exiled. That was one of my colleagues. Kathy walks across the room to stand alongside him. News from Spain? From the team? What the hell are they waiting for? Don't they have tear gas or something? When are they going to end this? Henry is surprised at his tone, which is more leaden than angry, not quite matching the words. His head feels the same, and he lets it hang down again, looking back at the cushion, noticing a small stain in the left upper corner. Ketchup, probably. Another image that makes him close his eyes. Anna lathering ketchup on a bacon sandwich. Nothing more from abroad, no. But there is something. Kathy's tone is unusually hesitant. A pause. What now? A ransom? He has been waiting for this, actually, and opens his eyes. Because if he wants money, we can get money. As much as he wants. We can sell the farm. Henry's mind is suddenly racing, thinking of all the people he might ring, who might chip in, lend, help. No, not a ransom. That's not something the team in Spain would want to countenance. Anyway, stupid of him. How did he think that would play out? Henry stops all the imaginary calls to friends and banks, the local church, the online appeal for cash. He lets go of the scene in his head, a bag of money for Carl, Anna being released from a car, running towards him.
Daddy!
His mind is exhausted from all the chopping and changing, the runaway ideas, the hopes raised and dashed, the horrible imaginings. From the news, all these blessed pictures on social media. The police aren't going to let Carl go, ransom or no ransom. There is no obvious way to make Anna safe. Nothing he can do. That burning in his chest again. Fists clenched tight, eyes fixed again on the cushion. I was wondering if I could ask you to look at a photograph, Mr. Ballard. Henry notices the formality. Kathy has encouraged them to use her first name. She always calls Barbara by hers. At first she called him Henry, all tea and sympathy and tilting of the head. But since the barn and the shotgun and the interview, he is Mr. Ballard. Will probably stay Mr. Ballard from here on, a whisker from suspect status, until this is all resolved.
You disgust me, Dad.
This photograph, Mr. Ballard, it hasn't been shared widely. I should warn you, it's another shot of Carl at the window with the gun, the very upsetting image, the one that was understandably too much for your wife. But it's taken from a different angle, and it would help if you would look at it very carefully for me, if you think you're up to that.
Of course I'm up to it.
A lie. Henry braces himself. He does not want to look. Kathy passes him not her iPhone, but her larger iPad. It's a shot taken from the flats opposite, from a higher angle. It's been tidied up a bit, and there's a zoom. She sweeps her finger across the screen to show him the second version. Henry feels his lip trembling.
So, what am I supposed to say? Supposed to be seeing?
Torture. He doesn't want to look at it. The gun. The hair. Carl has refused to let his hostage speak to the negotiator. Also, he hasn't sent a photograph through to the police team, which they have requested several times. It's standard procedure. To calm things down and to reassure that the hostage is okay. It's an exchange process. Bartering. If you send us a photograph or let us speak to the hostage, we will do this. Send in food or another phone or headache tablets or asthma inhalers or whatever it is he needs. The hostage. Why is she saying that? Why isn't she calling her Anna? How dare she? This is his daughter. She should use her name. What I'm asking is this. From this photograph, how sure can you be, Mr. Ballard, that this is definitely Anna? And now Henry's head is in a whirl. Is she serious? A maniac on a train talks his daughter into some seedy club after her theatre trip. He gets her drunk and God knows what. He kidnaps her. He takes her to Spain. He holes up in a flat with a gun and... Please look at the photograph very carefully. Especially the girl's body shape, her waist, the width of her shoulders in particular. Is that Anna? Henry looks at the image, feeling the ache of his frown. Shape? What does she mean? Shape? Only in this moment does he realize he has a terrible headache, maybe a migraine. He's had it for hours now, ever since the police station. The photograph is grainy, not good quality, especially in the zoomed version. The hair is definitely Anna's. I don't understand. Who the hell else could this be? Please, just look carefully. Henry stares at the girl, back to the window with a gun to her head. He finds that he is rocking his body now. He is thinking of Anna facing away from him, looking out of the kitchen window. Look, Daddy, there's that magpie back again. What is he supposed to be seeing in this picture? Body shape? What kind of person asks a father to think about his daughter's body shape? In this photograph, Anna is wearing a tight jumper. Grey, but that might be distorted by the camera, the picture almost certainly taken on a phone. Henry looks, as instructed, at the waist, the shoulders. A jarring. Something not right. Oh my God.
Are you saying she might be pregnant? Is that what you're implying?
Henry is fighting very hard not to lose it. He does not want to lose control in front of this woman. He looks again at the photograph and again feels the jarring. Something he cannot quite understand. No, that's not what I mean to imply. Her shape. Shoulders. Waist. We all have a set shape, Mr. Ballard. A ratio which doesn't change even when we lose weight or put on weight. Or even pregnancy. Though that isn't what I meant at all. Shoulder to hip ratio. Does this look like Anna to you? And now Henry is holding his breath as the enormity of the question and the consequence is sinking in.
I think we need to call Jenny down here.
Chapter 40. The Witness. I'm relieved that Tony has finally gone upstairs to change. He doesn't mean to be like that. I'm staring at Matthew, but my thoughts have followed my husband upstairs, watching him put his suit carrier behind the door, his toiletry bag back in the bathroom, tired, sitting on the bed, worried for me. No, don't apologize. It's good that he's protective. I'd be exactly the same if it were my wife, and I'm actually very glad we've met now. It's better. For you, I mean. I smile at this, as Luke comes into the kitchen, rummaging in the cupboard for the biscuit barrel. I consider stopping him. I really should make something proper to eat, but the strain of everything has thrown me.
I'm sorry, Matthew, how rude of me. I haven't even asked about the baby and your wife. How are they doing?
A change in Matthew's face is immediate. That bright and bemused sense of pride and disbelief, the punch-drunk expression of wonderment you carry in those early days. It's touching.
Great, thank you, really great.
She had a C-section, so is a bit fed up and a bit sore. Stuck in hospital for a few days.
Tell her to make the most of the rest. This is Luke, by the way, my son. Luke, this is the private investigator. Matthew. Remember, I told you.
I watch closely as Luke eyes Matthew with a wariness to match his father's. I feel defensive of both Tony and Luke suddenly. Matthew is right. It is good that they look out for me. I think of all that Luke has been through these past few weeks with his girlfriend, and feel disloyal and foolish for my suspicions over the stupid map magnifier. How on earth could I have gotten myself into such a muddle? I will not tell Matthew and I will not challenge Luke. Maybe the wretched thing was in my own pocket somehow. Yes, maybe I was the one who dropped it.
We having supper?
Luke is blanking Matthew and staring at me. Sometimes I wonder if life would have been easier for Luke with a sibling, someone to confide in, nearer his own age. We did try for another child. They never found anything wrong, but it just never happened. To be honest, I think I'll order something in. Do you fancy Chinese, Luke?
Great.
Once he has left the room, I confide in Matthew just how big a trial it has been for the whole family this past year. My fault. Me not being myself, so preoccupied with this case, especially since my name was leaked. The wretched postcards, longing for it all to end.
Are you sure there isn't anything else you need to tell me? About someone watching the shop? You didn't notice a car colour, anyone odd hanging around? At the shop? Or here?
No, just an odd feeling, really. You know, that sensation when you feel someone is watching. Like I say, I've been so jumpy. Probably paranoia because of those stupid postcards.
Okay.
Well, I'm sorry, Ella, but for now I'd better go.
Matthew is checking his watch.
You'd be welcome to stay. Share the takeaway. Even as the words slip from my mouth, I regret them.
No, very kind, but I have chores to do. But you know you can call me any time. If anything happens. If anything worries you.
Thank you. I find I am embarrassed by the extremity of my relief that he will not be staying for the meal. It will be so much more relaxing for Tony and Luke. I really must learn to put my family before my blessed manners. I like Matthew, but I have to remember this is his job. I switch the channel on the television so we can just quickly check there is no update from Spain before Matthew leaves. As he reaches into his pocket for his car keys, I hear a text buzz on his phone. Is it the case? He nods and is reading, his face darkening before looking up at me.
Okay, so this is in the strictest confidence, Ella, but there is some quite difficult news. I suspect it will be a while before this breaks openly, but I have a contact in touch with the Ballard family and, well, I feel you should know this now. I brace myself, muscles taut in my stomach. Also my arms, palms pressed flat into my thighs. I am looking at the television, where the shots of the flat in Spain show that the curtains are now drawn. A scrolling headline along the bottom of the screen says there have been no new developments. But I am afraid that Matthew is going to tell me the worst. The bubble of hope burst.
Is she dead? Has he killed her?
No, Ella. The woman in the flat. The hostage. It isn't Anna. We have no idea what the hell Carl is playing at, but it isn't Anna.
Chapter 41. The Friend.
Sarah is lying in Lily's bed, staring at her sister asleep on the blow-up mattress alongside. Lily is doing the same sweet thing she did as a small child, the index finger of her right hand pressing the tip of her nose. When they were little, Sarah would tease her.
Why do you do that, Lily? Push your nose up when you sleep.
Helps me breathe better.
That's ridiculous. I don't care.
The bracelets are still around Lily's wrist, and Sarah is wondering if she at least takes them off in the shower. Moon popped in earlier. Sarah is certain now that they are an item, but she is relieved he has backed off for now. Maybe Lily had a word when Sarah took a bath. Sarah is exhausted, and though the bath was soothing, she always knew she would struggle to sleep. She wanted to take the mattress on the floor, but Lily insisted. Even managed to joke.
I can keep an eye out for monsters under the bed. The room is thankfully not in pitch darkness. There is a small pane of glass above the door, letting in gentle light from the landing. Lily explained that a couple of others in the house suffer insomnia and bad dreams, so a gentle light is plugged in on the landing so they don't feel afraid when they have to get up in the night. Caroline, the woman who owns the house, is apparently returning in the morning, and Sarah is nervous. She needs to ask if she can stay a while. She can't bear the thought of returning to her mother, not after all she has learned from Lily. There have been more text messages pleading for her to come home, but Sarah has been curt with her replies, saying only that she is fine and that she is with Lily. Leave me be. But Sarah is torn. Like Lily, she is relieved that her father is not involved in Anna's disappearance, and yet it is a temporary relief, not a full stop. They surely have to do something about their father. They can't just pretend that the past didn't happen. What if he targets someone else? Won't that become partly their fault if they don't step up? Sarah can't believe that their mother wouldn't believe or support Lily when she told her. And now she feels her eyes scrunched up tight as she realizes she should have spoken up herself, done more to reach out to Lily rather than blaming her for abandoning the family. She moves as quietly as possible onto her back and tries to calm her thoughts, to examine the shadows around the room again. In the corner there is a shop dummy made of some kind of bamboo that Lily uses as a clothes stand, draped mostly with scarves and a patchwork poncho. In daylight she had admired it, very boho, but in the shadows it looks foreboding, like a headless person, and Sarah has to concentrate hard to pick out and identify all the items individually to make them less ominous. Scarf, scarf, poncho, just clothes, Sarah. And now, uncomfortable already on her back, she moves onto her side to examine the robe on the back of the door. It is so long that it trails on the floor, and Sarah finds herself thinking that they should move the hook higher up on the door. Yes, just a few inches and the robe won't get stuck under the door when it's opened. Then it is suddenly all confusion, sunlight, the swish of curtains, a tinkling of glasses or crockery, distant voices. By some miracle, she has slept. Sarah can't believe it. There is a rattling of china right alongside her, and Lily has a wooden tray with two pretty cups of coffee and a plate of something triangular and ominously green. Avocado on toast. No excuses. You really must eat something today, Sarah. Sarah yawns and stretches.
Okay.
Goodness, I can't believe I finally fell off.
She looks at the tray and reaches for a slice of the toast.
I will if you will.
She dips her head to signal that Lily should have the other slice. Her sister narrows her eyes, then takes the piece of toast and sits on the floor, pushing the mattress out of the way.
I honestly didn't think I would sleep. Last thing I remember, it was about 3 a.m.
Still, Sarah's voice is distorted by yawning.
So, do you think Caroline will let me stay a bit? I can look for a job in a cafe or something.
I don't know, but I'll ask. Only for the summer, mind. You need to get cracking with your A-levels.
Not sure I'll bother now.
Please don't say that, Sarah. I'm only asking if you can stay, if you promise you'll finish your exams. Sarah shrugs. The toast is nice. The surprise of lots of pepper on the avocado. Lemon, too. Popping the final piece into her mouth, she reaches down to the floor to pick up her phone. A string of messages. Sarah sits up, leaning back against the wooden headboard, and skims through them.
Oh, God.
She can't take this in.
Not Anna. How the hell can it not be Anna? What kind of new madness is this?
There are messages from Jenny, from Tim, from Paul, and other friends, too. She swipes to a news app and asks Lily to put up the newsfeed on her laptop again.
They're saying it's not Anna. The girl in the flat in Spain.
What? It takes a few minutes before the sound is up on the laptop. Lily and Sarah squeeze together on the edge of the bed, shoulders touching, to hear the reporter outside the flat in Spain confirm that the drama is finally over. Carl is now in custody, being questioned by police. It has been confirmed that the young woman allegedly being held hostage by Carl is not the missing English girl, Anna Ballard. Both Carl and the blonde woman in the flat are unharmed. Police are saying nothing further at the moment.
Not Anna. Lily is pale. This doesn't make any sense at all.
Sarah feels her hand come up to her mouth, her index fingers pressing into her lips. She can feel her sister trembling through the touching of their shoulders.
You know what this means, Lily.
Her sister leans forward, head in her hands, and Sarah gently rubs her back as Lily begins to cry.
I'm so sorry, darling. I know it's awful, Lily. I know it's not what you want. We have no choice now.
Lily carries on crying, and Sarah has no idea how to comfort her. They both know what they have to do. They have to go to the police about their father now. They have no choice. Sarah has to tell them everything.
Chapter 42. The Father.
The next week sees a heat wave, a great sweeping high on every forecast. Henry watches it with a quiet fury. The only time the weather people get it spot on, when you can look out the window and call it yourself. His daughter, meantime, is completely forgotten, no longer the headline. The local news is full instead of temperature charts, with chuffed tourist officers babbling about records being broken and how the staycation is back in fashion. The best season in years. All around Devon and Cornwall, faces turn a golden brown to match the grass. Today there is a news report about dolphins being seen more regularly and in bigger numbers off the coast, and some marine biologist is saying there could be more sharks soon. Global warming. Global warming. Yeah, right. Henry is packing some more of his clothes into another suitcase, the TV on quietly in the corner of the bedroom. Every time he returns to the house for more belongings, he drags things out as long as possible, hoping that Barbara's resolve will weaken, that she will make tea, talk to him, let him stay. But no. Her voice is now shouting up the stairs. She would like him to hurry up, please, to get his things before Jenny gets home. Their older daughter is out with Tim and Paul, apparently. Barbara says the boys have been her rock since things spiraled so terribly. And now we are all back in the most appalling limbo, Henry thinks, as he zips his case. Anna is still gone, the news obsessed with the wretched weather, and I am in exile. Back downstairs, he tries one more time.
Can we at least talk, Barbara? Try again, for Jenny. Try? You have the nerve to ask me to try, after you practically blow your head off in the barn, and then I find out you have been putting it about on our very doorstep, off with some local whore, while our daughter...
Henry still has no idea how Barbara has found out about his fling. She doesn't know who yet, thank God, but she's put the pieces together somehow. He suspects Kathy has deliberately let it slip, though she firmly denies this. Since the Spain debacle, their family liaison officer is no longer with them as much, just checks in daily for a coffee and a chat, probably embarrassed about the complete pig's ear the police have made of the whole inquiry. The Spain siege turned out to be no such thing. They learned that the blonde in the flat with Carl was his new girlfriend. The two of them staged the whole hostage thing, to try to negotiate for a getaway car. Made it up as they went along, when the police first turned up to arrest Carl after a tip-off. All the ballads have been told since is that Carl seems to have an alibi for the night Anna went missing. Anthony has turned up on the same building site in Spain too, both now in custody, both denying any involvement whatsoever in Anna's disappearance. Their story is that they lost interest in the two girls within the first hour at the club and have no idea what happened to them. The lads say they went to a party with friends after the club in Vauxhall, which was always their plan. This new information has been cross-checked with witnesses and CCTV, and so far all the images and statements seem to confirm this story. To date, the Met team have not been able to find any gaps in the timeline that would suggest any involvement in Anna's disappearance. The two men say they only did a runner early the next morning for fear of being blamed or framed. They believed they would go straight back inside. So mates provided false passports and a boat crossing to France. Forensic teams have checked the flat where the party was held. New alibis are still being grilled. But so far, zilch. Carl's girlfriend, the so-called hostage, is an English waitress he met in a bar 6 months back. The Ballards have been assured Carl and Anthony will almost certainly be heading back to jail for jumping parole and for Carl's fake siege. But as far as Anna is concerned, the police seem slowly to be dismissing the two men as suspects, and they have no other leads. The DI is back in London, apparently distracted yet again by his serial killer case. So, what the hell now? Henry keeps asking. We are continuing inquiries. The case is very much still live. In this heat, Henry is slowly facing his greatest fear, that they will never find their daughter, never find out what happened. To imagine this as his future, all their futures, is unbearable. He sees it in Jenny's eyes too, and his wife's. In this terrible limbo, Barbara has finally given in to antidepressants, but seems to be suffering severe mood swings as a result. According to Jenny, the problem is that she refuses to take them every day, and the inconsistency in the dose is playing havoc with her system. Henry never knows how he will find her, dull and quiet, with all the light gone out of her eyes, or manic, cleaning the house over and over and shouting at him whenever he tries to reason with her. You should see the doctor again, Barbara.
It's no longer any of your business what I do, Henry.
He feels this punch inside. Not just guilt, he finds, but a deep and all-pervading sadness. I still love you, Barbara. As he says this, he realizes much too late that it is true, and he wishes he could turn back the clock to dilute his irritation, his dissatisfaction with this life, farmer-turned-campsite manager.
Well, lucky old me, eh?
I'm not giving up on this family, Barbara. We have to think about Jenny.
What family, Henry?
She spits this out at him.
In case you hadn't noticed, we don't have a family anymore. Anna is gone, and I don't know that we are ever going to get her back. And Tim and Paul are thinking more about Jenny's needs than you ever did.
That's not fair.
Fair? I'll tell you what's not fair. That you don't even have the guts or the decency to tell me who you were with when our daughter went missing.
Sammy is standing by Henry's side, and he can feel the tension in the dog's posture. Tail down, eyes down.
Oh, just get lost, will you, Henry, and take your dog with you.
I'll be in touch.
Can't wait.
Henry wheels the suitcase behind him out to the Land Rover and pretends it is heavy as he lifts it into the back. The truth is he is taking only a few items of clothing at a time for the excuse to return, still hoping that Barbara will reconsider. He is finding it hard to believe that this is it. All gone. He glances one more time at the front lawn, closes his eyes to that picture of Anna turning cartwheels, then sitting and smiling, waving at him. He feels his fingers flicker, wanting to wave back at her. Finally, he pushes his lips together very, very tightly, opens his eyes, and drives along the narrow approach road out to the holiday lets, one of the larger original barns converted into a row of 4 units. For now, Henry is using one of the 2 beds. It feels like playing at life rather than actually living it, not least because the neighboring 3 units are full of holidaymakers, and the yard full of bodyboards, wetsuits, laughter, and an awful lot of sand. Henry takes the suitcase into the sad little bedroom with its neutral walls, neutral bedding, and fake oak floor. Barbara spent a lot of time explaining to him during the conversion that practicality was the watchword. Also ROI, which he learned stands for return on investment. The fittings and fixtures needed to be neutral, hard-wearing, and easily maintained, she explained. It was not about personal taste or personal choice, but about ROI. He stares down at the easily maintained floor and thinks of the richer, original oak floors in the upstairs of the farmhouse, the twists and the knots, the lumps and the bumps. Henry lies on the bed and stares at the ceiling. He thinks of his preferred world, the real world he still clings to. The hay sorted, thanks to the weather, the lambs weaned and turned out onto the grass. What next? He must decide whether to begin ploughing the upper fields for next year's cereals. Should he even bother? Is all this playing at farming going to continue even? He looks around the room.